Hello, everybody. This is Hashim of Economics, or Hashim of Iqtisadiyata, and today our guest is University of Chicago law professor Tom Ginsburg. Welcome, Tom.
Thanks, Beck. It's great to be with you. Very excited to speak with you today.
I want to introduce you briefly to our audience, correct me if I am characterizing it wrongly, if at all. So Tom Ginsburg is a leading scholar in questions of constitutions. He has extensive experience in working and writing about constitutions across the globe. He holds degrees in political science and law from University of California, Berkeley. So he has this political science background to the law that I really like. Recently has been writing about the decline of democracies in the West. But before that, he was very prolific in the topic of how law and constitutions in the developing world are shaped and are written. So I want to talk to you about that. Did I get it correctly?
That's perfect. Yeah, okay. Exactly. Okay.
So my first question is, why countries need constitutions?
Yeah. Well, so first of all countries have something you'd call a constitution in a small c sense. They have fundamental rules of the game, institutional structures which guide behavior. And wow, now for about 60 years, economists have been very interested in this through the discipline of what we might call constitutional political economy or constitutional economics, coming out of the Virginia School of James Buchanan. And the way Buchanan thought about it was that, you know, rules of the game are important. Constitutions are rules about rules, the rules for how law gets made, the rules for how political agents can act. And therefore, they're of supreme importance for thinking about how economic life and social life will be undertaken. So those fundamental rules are really important. Now, since the late 18th century and accelerating after World War II, a written constitution is a norm for being a country. Frank Zappa, who's a very famous rock and roll musician, used to say, you can't be a real country unless you have a beer and an airline. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could get away without the airline, but you needed a national beer. Mm-hmm. Well, nowadays, I think we'd have to add constitutions to that list because it's almost the first act you do when you become independent. You write a constitution, and that tells other states who you are, who you're dealing with. It tells the people internally what your goals and values are, and fundamentally provides really important structures for governance.
So, but like, there are countries that don't have constitutions, like the UK would be probably the prime example.
Yeah.
And it seems like for their quality of life or for their human dignity and human rights, it's not as essential. So are you saying this only applies to the newly independent states?
Well, first of all, I'd say that the degree to which the constitution, the written constitution actually is important is a variable.
Yeah.
It's not as if some countries it's all the way and others not. In the United Kingdom, they do speak about a constitution, although that has been kind of breaking down because what they meant by that is a certain set of norms by which everyone who went to Oxford and Cambridge all agreed the country would be governed. And they didn't have to write them down because there's only a small handful of people running the society. Now, you notice in the United Kingdom, they're having devolution with these governments in Scotland with their own parliaments and Northern Ireland and such. There's a lot of pressure on them to write a written constitution. You know, another country I'd mention is Israel, which has never had a written constitution because they couldn't agree at the founding of the state. And that allowed the current prime minister, Netanyahu, to try to attack the courts in the last
Probably
year.
This year.
Year, before the explosion in Gaza, he spent the previous part of the year kind of undermining what most people would call the small-c constitution of the country. So I think there's nowadays more and more countries recognize there's some virtue in having a fundamental set of rules, even if getting a stable set that really functions and that is respected is a very difficult task.
I'm from Uzbekistan, and our neighbors, or neighboring country to Uzbekistan that wasn't part of Soviet Union, there's only one, which is Afghanistan. And they have had a constitution after American invasion. Mm. And with the help of American legal scholars and lawyers, they have actually written down very pluralistic constitution that seemed to be, how can I say, cutting edge, if you will, or like the how can I say, very modern in many senses. But it turns out it wasn't sufficient for a country to be stable or prosperous.
That's true.
Do you have a copy of that constitution?
Well, I was there. I'm just going to grab my book.
Oh, okay.
I was there in 2002 and 2003.
Okay.
I sent some memos to that constitution drafting committee on judicial review and topics.
It was in Bonn, right, or something?
Well, there was a meeting in Bonn, and then there was a drafting commission that actually took place in a very traditional Afghan way. They had what they call
Loya Jirga.
Yeah, exactly, which is a kind of invented tradition. But still, it had a lot of legitimacy. There were some technical problems. They decided to make it a centralized unitary state.
Like a Jefferson presidency? Or like,
And obviously that was a big problem. They ended up being very hyper-presidential. Yeah. And, you know, they didn't pick the right guy necessarily. You know, so this book that I just picked down, I got down because I wanted to look at something I'd said about the Afghan constitution.
Sure.
This is a book called The Endurance of National Constitutions. And what it asks is, what is it that makes national constitutions last a long time? What makes them enduring? Most of them don't last a long time. One of the things we discovered in this book, we used like a epidemiological model, statistical model of life expectancy. Mm-hmm. So using the tools of economics to study constitutional life. And, you know, our framework was that there are some things which are in control of the drafters of a constitution, just like there's some things I could do for my health to make me live a long life. I could exercise and eat well. But there's also certain genetic conditions and environmental conditions. And, you know, if a war started here, my life expectancy would go down, even if I was the healthiest person and behaved well.
Yeah.
And, you know, certain countries also don't seem to be good soil for enduring constitutions. So we have this, like, complicated model. And what we did is we predicted, using that model, how long it would be for Afghans' constitutions, how long we thought it would last. And let's see what we say here. Afghanistan's constitution, we predicted, using this model, would only last 14 years from 2004 when it was adopted. So it did a little better than expected because it lasted till 2021 but didn't last very long. We also looked at Iraq, and we predicted that the Iraq constitution, which was also imposed in some ways, would last for 59 years. We'll see. I'll be long gone by the time that prediction gets proved wrong. But that's the framework I think about this in.
So, how can I say? It feels like if you read, let me ask a clarifying question first and then the actual question. Do you think that in a modern sense of the word, United States of America and its constitution was like the first modern constitution in that sense or not?
We usually say it's the first constitution of a nation state, yes.
Okay.
And it started a practice of nation states writing constitutions.
So given that, so starting from, late 18th century, United States, when it was established, they wrote a constitution. And for me, when I read it as a non-legal scholar, I feel like constitution was more about things that governments cannot do. It was more like, how can we restrict power so that the so-called concept of checks and balances are introduced, that no political group or institution, sorry for not using the most rigorous word here, will take over the whole power in the society. So it feels like the constitution is a document to distribute power so that it's sustainable. That's my understanding of why constitutions exist.
Mm-hmm.
But in the modern world, like if you read constitutions that were written in Iraq, Afghanistan, or Uzbekistan for that matter, or other countries, it feels more like about the rights of people and what they should or shouldn't have, rather than like sort of dividing power necessarily. Don't you think there is a lot more stuff going on in modern constitutions with respect to that?
There's certainly a lot more stuff going on, and they're much longer.
They're much
longer. They're full of all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Even the preambles of constitutions have gotten longer over time, which are like the sections where they sort of talk about the hopes and dreams of the country. So there's much more in them. There's more institutions, more rights. There's been a huge explosion in the things people have rights to. But, you know, I would say that in some ways, it's that rights and division of powers fulfill the same goal, some of the rights, from an economic perspective, it's the same goal, which is to prevent government predation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's really, I think, the original idea of our economic reading of the American Constitution. Nowadays, what you're seeing is what we would call much more positive rights. So citizens are told you get healthcare and education, spending, you know, things from the government. And that's controversial. It seems to have carried the day in the sense most new constitutions include all those things, even in poor countries that couldn't possibly deliver them.
Like Uzbek constitution may have clauses about healthcare, for example,
Stuff like that. Right. Yeah. And I always say, look, the fact that, you know, maybe they're unable to meet the promises of the constitution, certainly the minute it's adopted, still it could play a valuable function in terms of orienting the society and pushing the state towards that goal. So it's like a blueprint for the society we want to become, more than a description of the society that we're in now. But again, from an economic perspective, one thinks about this as the shift from protection against government expropriation or appropriation to a much more redistributive model, and that raises trade-offs.
So I was thinking that the Constitution is this document that protects against the Leviathan. Am I right in that sense or not really?
Well, James Madison thought about this. He said, look, we need a government, obviously, to protect us.
Correct.
But the problem in designing a constitution is you need a government that is strong enough to protect us, but not so strong to become a threat to us.
Correct.
And that is the problem of Leviathan, in a sense. And you know, of course, Madison had read Hobbes, and so you know he it really informed his thinking. And his answer was, as you started out, checks and balances. If we have a government that is kind of, in some sense, at war with itself, you know, that you have different branches battling for power, that will protect the people. That was his theory. And I think there's something to it. You know, in the United States, we have branches of government that compete with each other. It leads to inefficiency in service delivery.
Yeah.
It leads to a lack of responsiveness. But on the other hand, it minimizes the amount, the maximum pain that government could cause us.
So if you were to design the constitutions, given what you learned with epidemiological models of their longevity, what are the parameters that you think are sort of undervalued by modern constitution writers?
So one of the things we emphasize, or we learned in the book, is that constitutions that last a long time are fairly flexible. I think that's intuitive, that they're relatively easy to change. U.S. Constitution is very hard to change. Easy to change allows you to be responsive to changing circumstances, but there's also a risk because a temporary set of power holders could change the thing to their benefit. So flexibility, I think, is one lesson. We also discovered that...
But flexibility is good for longevity.
Yeah, it is. It's good for longevity. We also find that constitutions that are written very inclusively, with all the major interest groups represented, perhaps with the public involved, that's good because then the public knows about the Constitution, they're able to help enforce it. The final factor we discovered was that more detailed constitutional texts tend to last longer. And, you know, examples might be India or Mexico. These are very, very long constitutions. They contain all kinds of detail that looks much more statutory. And my explanation for why that helps with endurance is that if you have a provision like, I don't know, the one on the right to education in the Mexican Constitution, it's about 5 pages long. It's all about benefits for the teachers' union. And from an economic perspective, well, Sam, that's kind of a deadweight loss. That's a special interest group that's captured the Constitution. But on the other hand, what it does, it means that when someone comes along and says, I want to get rid of this thing, which is exactly what's going on in Mexico today as we're talking, you know, the teachers union says, I'm not sure we'll do better under the next constitution, so maybe you want to keep this thing. So the one way to think about this is, it's a, again, thinking from an economic perspective, the optimal amount of interest group activity is not zero. It might be positive. Just like the optimal amount of corruption might not be zero because counter-corruption has a cost too. And so to get a long-lasting constitution, which has all kinds of benefits in terms of stability, we might get a little deadweight loss in the form of interest group bargains.
I mean, I think the most obvious example to that is Soviet constitution, which had the clause, Article 6, I think it's called, special status of the party in deciding affairs of the country. I'm translating it very liberally from Russian right now, but like basically the Article number six, I think, was the premise that would give the Communist Party the domination in affairs.
Yeah.
It's a very, it's a special interest group, a specific party.
Absolutely, yeah.
But that had, but you know, the, I think people call it, how can I say, freedom when this article was abolished, right? Like, so.
For sure. Well, that's obviously more than an interest group. That's, you know, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was more than an interest group. That was not just a political party, yeah. Obviously. So, you know, you're talking about a totalitarian kind of framework. And of course, its decline led to greater liberty. You know, I mean, in general, of course, you can't always tell what's going to happen in the society from the text.
Correct.
And here we have the famous example of Stalin's 1936 constitution.
Yeah.
Which in some of my work I describe as a kind of a very complicated form of window dressing. Usually we think of window dressing as something that helps it look beautiful from the outside. But there's another function that a window dressing might have, like a curtain over the window, actually keeps people on the inside from looking out.
Huh.
So what Stalin was doing, I think, and he did spend a lot of time on the drafting personally, he spent a lot of time himself, and you think, well, what is Stalin wasting time? I know he was busy slaughtering this public, but he took time from killing people to spend time on this constitution. Why did he do it? And my theory is that what he was doing is thinking about the propagandistic power of telling people inside the Soviet Union that all of these rights that you see in the U.S. and these other things, these are also just completely fake. Constitution as a form is just a propaganda. And he wanted the people inside to think that about the West as well. That's my theory.
Oh, so you're saying that the inclusiveness of Soviet Constitution was a charade, not for the West per se, but also for the inner audience, saying that, you know, we also have the protection of speech, assembly, and all other democratic things. Like, remember, like Soviet Constitution specifically.
Yeah.
Specifically mentions freedom of assembly and protest against the government.
Yeah,
exactly. Right. Like in the 36th Constitution, right?
Yeah,
and so,
yeah.
But it's. I don't think U.S. Constitution has that rights enshrined.
Well, we have that one. We do have freedom of assembly, but
no, not free, so freedom of demonstrations. I think.
Yeah,
sorry,
we don't say that. We don't say.
Yeah,
you're right.
So sorry. Yeah, freedom of assembly. U.S. Constitution has it. U.S. Constitution doesn't have freedom of I need to translate it very fast, but like, let's call it demonstrations, freedom of demonstrations.
Yeah, and protest.
Protest, like, yeah. It's not explicitly mentioned in the U.S. Constitution, as I remember it.
That's right.
But it is explicitly mentioned in the Stalinist Constitution.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the reason he put that out was that everybody who had the sane mind at that time knew that this was charade. So he was doing that, you're saying, to show his own citizens that they are also playing that charade, and look how bad is our, like, is that?
I'm thinking he had two purposes. One is to fool the Western leftists.
Liberals, okay.
The leftists, the communists in the United States. Look, you know, Uncle Joe is doing this wonderful thing, and they have freedom in the Soviet Union. But I think it also had that effect in the country as well. Yes, here's this constitution, and you can read it on your way to the gulag. And if you want to protest that, feel free.
I
think it's a sophisticated thing, because we do have to have an account of why Mao Zedong also spent a lot of time in 1954 writing the Chinese Constitution. Personally, he was very involved. Why would a leader spend so much time? So it has significant propagandistic value, I think, for them. And it's not like, you know, the question is, why were people fooled and why so?
Don't you think, I think the proponents of Stalin, which unfortunately now there are many.
True?
In modern Russia, he's one of the most popular politicians. Like according to surveys, which is, again, very sad. But, you know, they would say this. They would say, no, the way they were writing these constitutions was aspirations. They were thinking that they're gonna slaughter a lot of people and subjugate the rest. But aspirationally, that's what they wanted to. So you don't buy that.
In the future communist time and such?
Yeah. In Nirvana.
I would feel better about that if they were more explicit about the different phases of socialist and communist development in the text. They're not particularly detailed about that. you could imagine a programmatic constitution. We have many examples of this. The government of Augusto Pinochet, for example, passed a constitution as he was leaving power that sort of sets up a transformational structure to get to the better world that he wanted, and then his group would fade from power. A good Marxist theorist would develop something like that in a constitution. That's not really what they did in the Soviet Union. Really, it's dictatorship of the proletariat and, you know, consolidating the dominance of the Soviet Communist Party.
I see.
That's my view.
One of the things I stumbled upon when I was preparing for this talk was that I read discussions of like people and blogs about like constitutions, and one thing I noticed reading like Russian blogosphere was that you know, why do we even care about constitutions if for society's economic benefit it doesn't matter? Do you buy that line of thinking?
Well, it's interesting. It's very difficult to connect written constitutions with economic growth. It's just hard to do. There's so many other things going on. You know, as an economist, there's like lots of different factors. And so there's a lot of endogeneity to studying the effects of constitutions on any outcome. And so, you know, that said, I do think we can point to specific outcomes where, you know, certain economic functions have to be protected, and constitutions can help with that. Protection of basic property rights, some amount of investment in human capital and things like this. You can freeze, constitutions can affect those things, the way they work on the ground. So I do think they have an effect. Independence of the central bank and things like this, they do have an effect. But there's not a magic constitution that's going to change a country to a growth trajectory if they've got bad policies or they have a basically, I guess Robinson and Acemoglu would say, a non-inclusive structure, extractive structure.
So I guess more kind of specific question would be, if a constitution says the court should be independent from the government, most of the constitutions in the world say it implicitly or explicitly, judiciary is a different branch than executive, right? You know, and in many places in the world, that's not the case. That judiciary is, you know, at worst, it's just a rubber stamping decisions of that is already made, and at best, it's like quasi independent. Many sort of non free countries and so forth. How can they, if in this important setting such as the division of power, the constitution cannot guarantee what it's written? How can it guarantee the power of much weaker institutions, such as, for example, central bank, or you know, the sort of like attorney general, or like other, you know, bodies or like institutions in the government or around the government that are much weaker by design? How can a constitution defend those weaker elements if they cannot defend the basic division of powers? You see what I mean, or not?
Yeah. Well, to the extent you're asking about specifically judicial power, which is, of course, of central importance in constitutional design, you know, it's an empirical question about what constitutional provisions can help protect judicial independence. Mm-hmm. And I have a paper on it. What we discover in that paper is, you know, there's many things a constitution could say about the courts. It could just say merely that they are supposed to be independent, it's just a declaration. They could protect the appointment process by making sure that there are multiple bodies involved in appointing judges, so no faction or no body can dominate it. They can protect judges' salaries. They can protect judges from removal, etc. There's all these provisions. What we discover is that in looking at a whole bunch of different countries, in terms of comparing the constitutional provisions with a measure of de facto judicial independence on the ground, is that it's the combination of having protected modes of appointing judges as well as protection from removal. You need both of them together. And that combination does seem to lead to systematically higher levels of judicial independence. It's the kind of thing that we can do with our research program using my large N statistical data and approaching constitutions, we can find ways, better design principles. But even that, of course, is just an average effect. And so you could imagine that there might be some constitution where the politicians manage to control the judges, even if they do have these constitutional guarantees.
So do you think this is this should be so? It seems like the procedural details of like how judges are appointed or how they're fired are usually in the laws, but not in the
right
constitutions.
And that's true. But constitutions can constrain those laws.
Yeah, I see.
So, for example, if the U.S. Constitution says the salaries of judges shall not be reduced while they're in office, because otherwise, if you could reduce the judges' salaries, well, then you know you'd be able to threaten them and get them under control. Yeah. And so, that's an example of how, even if we have a law on judicial salaries, it can't reduce them. Now there's inflation. There's lots of ways that the politicians can disincentivize people from being good judges. But at the end of the day, that one seems to work pretty well. So constitutions still matter because they shape the lawmaking process. They constrain the lawmaking process.
I see. So when Uzbekistan started reforming a couple of years ago, I was invited to some discussions about like what to do, you know, how can we reform the country. And one of the things I said, we should basically give the courts a chance. We should make judiciary independent. We should basically enforce the constitution as it's written. And one of the pushback I got in that discussion, and which I think is very common, was that, you know, it takes a long time to reform a judiciary, but we need sort of economic results today.
Yeah.
And my, I had my thoughts, but if somebody asks you that kind of thing, saying, you know, we know obviously that rule of law is important for growth. And to enforce rule of law, you need judiciary. But it takes a long time to get there.
Yeah.
How would you respond to that?
Well, look, I mean, institutions matter. That's my belief. I think there's a lot of evidence that institutions matter. Institutions are very hard to grow.
Yeah.
They're very easy to destroy. They're, you know, it's mysterious how you get from, let's say, a country, hypothetical country with a very corrupt, low-quality judiciary, how do you get to a high-quality, independent one? And there's a lot of, like, little micro steps that would be involved in that process. So I guess I'd say, if you think you can have short-term growth without doing that institutional work, I can tell you one thing, that growth won't be sustained, and it'll never reach a stage of sort of takeoff and self-sustaining investment and entrepreneurship by people with high levels of human capital. You really can't do that without independent institutions like courts and commissions and a pretty good bureaucracy and things like this. So I don't think it's an either-or choice, and I think you've got to find ways to do both at once. That's my view. I'd be interested to what the other argument is. Well, we can't afford to stop interfering with the courts.
The other argument is that, you know, we need like increase in quality of life today, and if we invest our political power, money, and resources into improving judiciary, it may eventually in 50 years pay off. But like, people need food today, sort of. I mean, that was the thing I'm saying is a literal quote from that meeting.
Yeah.
You know, I obviously disagree with that view, because I think, you know, the time will pass anyways. You might as well have a judiciary that would have ability to enforce, you know, rule of law. Having said that, you have written about the difference between rule of law and by law.
Yeah, rule by law, yeah.
So, you're a pioneer, I think, in that philosophy.
Yeah.
I would want to say that, if I may.
Well, yeah, look, I think I've looked at... So my original field of study was East Asian political economy. I studied Japan and Korea, Taiwan in the high growth period. I've done a lot of work on China. And so those countries, particularly in the early years of growth in the 19th century in Japan and such, these were not democracies by any chance. They were authoritarian regimes in which law was still something that they were trying to empower. They thought, we need to build institutions. They really did. We need to build institutions that will allow us to stay independent of these Western powers that are trying to control us. We need institutions to sustain growth. But we certainly don't want institutions that are going to constrain the flexibility of the policymakers at the center to undertake the steps.
Reforms, they, yeah.
So this is kind of a model of an authoritarian developmental state. And it was highly effective. As we know, Japan obviously is one of the richest countries in the world. And we see modern examples like Singapore is basically a one-party developmental state. So, you know, I would characterize those countries as having rule by law. And I think it's good. I think it's better than rule by man, rule by a good, you know, you get lucky that your dictator happens to be good, you know, but for every Lee Kuan Yew, you know, there's a Kim Jong-un or a Kim Jong-il or something like that.
You know, Vladimir Gelman, Russian political scientist, says for every Lee Kuan Yew, there are 70 Mugabes.
Yeah, exactly. 70. Like that. That's good. Okay. So I should change my framing. I have always used North Korea, but yes, exactly. It's much easier to be Mugabe. Correct. A demagogue and an expropriator than an institution builder. Because Lee Kuan Yew was an institution builder. And so, you know, I think that that means rule by law is worth studying. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't think of, even we can call it rule of law, good quality legal institutions are not an exclusive province of democracies. On the other hand, it's risky because it requires basically pretty honest leadership. In other words, if you're in that system, Lee Kuan Yew was not stealing the public fisc or anything like that. And so he wasn't afraid of the institutions, you know, providing for good quality administration at the low level because he wasn't abusing those things down below. So, so in any case, I think rule by law is important. I think it's better than no rule, no law at all. It's better than rule of man, but obviously, rule of law is a better thing, where you could imagine that it could constrain the center. China has obviously been going through a lot of discussions about this because they've invested so much in law and legality. And I think that's had a genuine effect. I've written about this. I honestly think that the average Chinese citizen likes the fact that they can go to court and likes the fact that they can complain about the administration and that law is playing some role in governance. But at the same time, there's no rule of law. Obviously, the party is not genuinely constrained by law. And it's maintains a kind of flexibility, which has led to more complicated forms of authoritarianism. Still, I think it's probably better off than it would have been, you know, had it not invested in legal institutions. Let me put it that way.
So what do you mean by rule of law, or like you just said, that China, like Chinese Communist Party, doesn't feel that it's constrained by the rule of law.
Right.
How does it look like in sort of real terms? Like, let's just make a counterfactual saying, what does it mean when people in power or party in power is constrained by rule of law? Like, who is law there that would lead to the good behavior? Is it like... How does it? I'm asking this almost like a practical question. By law, do you mean who? There's like a court martial. Do you mean the army? Do you mean like how to constrain like bad behavior?
If you think about it, a very high level of abstraction, you want the people at the center of the system to follow the rules that were set out in advance, and that might be by courts.
Yeah.
But of course, a lot of countries don't have strong courts that are capable of this. But you might have other actors that are ensuring that they do so. So you know. Take a couple of American presidents. Richard Nixon obviously broke the law and was held to account by that, by the courts. The media played a role, and ultimately his own party played a role in removing him from power because he broke the law. And that's not going to be true of most leaders in most times. When Donald Trump tried to overthrow our presidential election system, it wasn't so much the courts which constrained him, that those cases are still working. It was people in the military and the police and such, and even judges that he appointed, you know, that Donald Trump had appointed, saying, you know, we have to follow the rules here. We can't just follow you. And that's what the rule of law looks like. So ideally, it's instantiated in lots of different institutions. All that said, the easiest way to imagine it is, you know, if Xi Jinping breaks the law in China, there's no court that is going to hold him responsible.
Correct.
And so that's an example of how it really isn't the rule of law. The people at the very center of the power have no legal constraint.
Yeah, so the absence of rule of law is really easy to see.
Yeah, exactly.
What I'm asking more is like for an audience that may is not familiar with presence of rule of law, let's just put it this way. Who are the law enforcers of, so the U.S. president? And you gave an example of Nixon, in which case it was his political party that made him accountable, and they impeached him, I think. And then he resigned, right?
He wasn't. Yeah, he did resign. Yeah,
he did resign. But like, you know, in most of the non-democratic places, people in power don't resign.
Yeah, yeah.
When public is not happy with them.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, who are the? So in Russian, there is a saying. It's called the "sudyi kto," means like who are the judges of the. Implicitly, it means like who are the judges of the powerful. That's the point.
Yeah,
of
yeah, and we sometimes say even in a case where you do have courts, who guards the guardians?
It's something like that. Yeah,
old,
yeah.
Old phrase from the Romans. They had this question of who guards the guardians of legality, and it's a mystery. It's always an enduring mystery, and. You know, there's lots of, it's basically, one way to think about this is an agency problem. Mm-hmm. You know, society is the principal. We hire these agents, the judges, to watch out for the other agents. And how do we make sure that those agents have are obeying the rules? There's many ways to solve a principal-agent problem. And a good one, if you can get them to do it, is to have them internalize an ideology of compliance, of, you know, it wouldn't be right for me to do this, a sense of morality. So that's great if you can get that. If you can't get that, you either have some sort of hierarchical system, like a party, where the people from below won't obey a ruler who's, they don't want that ruler as a champion because they think it might hurt them in the next election or something like that, or a third party. Those are basically the solutions to agency problems. And third parties raise the issue you bring up. Who guards the guardians? How do we make sure the judges are acting on behalf of the principal rather than in their own interests? It's an enduring problem. We confront this all the time, even in very advanced democracies. And this is where I think Madison's genius comes in. Because you can't trust, there's no magic institution. It's not like judges are always, by virtue of being judges, you know, honest, brilliant people. But when you have a multiplicity of institutions with different roles, the chance that one of them is going to be honest is heightened. I think about this now in terms of a question you asked about before. Constitutions are now much more, they're longer, they're more elaborate, they're more institutionally articulated.
Correct.
And that means that the probability, in one sense, the more different government institutions you have, the more difficult it is for a political party to take over all of them. And we've just seen a very good example of this in Poland. Poland under the Law and Justice Party was wasn't that popular a party, but it, you know, had majority support, and they took over the judges, they appointed some judges illegally, they took over many institutions of society, but there was one that they couldn't really control, and that was the ombudsman, a man named Adam Bodnar, and he had been appointed before they took power, and he was serving out his term. And having even just one institution they didn't control was good for allowing him to sort of speak truth to power, to tell people when they were doing wrong, to issue reports that then ended up being acted upon by the European Union and by the public ultimately when they threw the Law and Justice Party out of the lower house, out of power in the lower house recently last year. So I think networks of institutions, I'm not saying that there's one magic kind of institution, which is always good. But networks of institutions are what help defend the rule of law.
So, how can I say? I'm not sure it's exactly let me formulate in a second. I think when the U.S. Constitution has been written, there was this instance where one of the writers of the Constitution walks out of the building, and then a citizen approaches him and says, you know, is it a republic or a monarchy? And then the one of the writers of the Constitution says it's a republic if we can keep it, right?
Yes, exactly.
And I felt that this is very true in recent events of the January 6th in the U.S. It felt like to me, as a non-American and an observer of that event, was that loyalty of few individuals was absence of loyalty of those individuals to the president, but to the law, made sure the transition happened. And I don't want to even imagine the counterfactual world where, say, like, I don't know, Mike Pence doesn't go, like, if he didn't certify, what would happen? I'm not sure, like, what are the legal repercussions of that, but it feels like this, how can I say, the beliefs of people who are making decisions, yeah. like the vice president or yeah. the head of the military, were a lot more instrumental than any legal constraints per se. Like a lot of takeover by authoritarians happened because the loyalty of other institutions, other people who are heading these institutions are under question, right? Am I thinking?
Well, I think the law is underneath it. Mike Pence was thinking about the law when he was deciding to certify the election. And the way I think about this is the way I think about the rule of law. Ex post accountability, which we're seeing happen, turns out to be super important. Suppose Trump gets elected again. Mm-hmm. Could happen. I don't think it's going to happen. You heard it here first. But let's say he does. Now he's going to hire a bunch of idiots and yes people. Who the first criteria will be loyalty. Now, comes to the end of the administration, his term is coming up, and he decides he wants to stay in power.
Okay.
Happens in many countries, yes. as you know. So what would happen if he tries to do that? Now, because of what's happening now, all these idiots around him are going to think to themselves, wow, I can follow this guy, and I might get more power if he is able to stay on for a few yes. more years. On the other hand, there's some probability, positive probability, and they've updated yeah. in a Bayesian way.
Yeah.
I'm going to end up in jail like the January 6th rioters, or I'm going to lose my law license, yeah. like it's going to happen to John Eastman, and so on. And so the fact is, it's those people who the rule of law depends on, because mm-hmm. a leader himself can never do anything as an individual. He always needs a cohort. And so you want that cost-benefit calculation to be one in which there are consequences. And notice in my example, it's not just the courts. The professional association might have some consequences. Your reputation, maybe your friends are never going to talk to you again. Like there's lots of mechanisms which would help to incentivize compliance with the law. But at the end of the day, having the rules is important too. The military commanders who in theory reported to Donald Trump were saying to themselves, we can't go along with this because that would be the end of our military as an institution. It would violate some aspect of our oath and our duty. So the law mattered.
I see. But this is happening in a country with more than 200 years of
I get it. Yeah.
legal tradition
yeah.
and pluralistic institutions and rule of law that has been happening for a long time.
Yeah.
How, you know, as a legal scholar, you would think that may happen in a country with a nascent institution that just start, like, you know, Supreme Court justice in the U.S., there have been, like, dozens of them. There's a tradition. There's, like, portraits in the hallways of law schools of them or whatever, right? But Supreme Court of some country, like Russia, for example, just recently the founding Supreme Court justice of Russia died, like, last year.
Zorkin?
Yeah, I think so. He was there since 1992 or something.
Okay,
right?
Yeah.
So like this is like the first generation, basically.
Yeah.
And if some other legal mind would change their, it's not like they're breaking a tradition. It's like, oh, you know, it's a powerful position. I can use it for my own benefit. Like I think, I guess my interest is like, how does it happen? Not at the tail end of the, or like not at the nth iteration, but
yeah.
But I'm interested in the nth iteration where it is. N is a very, very small number, maybe
no,
two or three or something.
It's a challenge. And again, there's no magic answer. Do you know the famous paper by Barry Weingast, Democracy and the Rule of Law, from 1997?
It's a political science paper, right?
Yeah, APSR, yeah. American Political Science Review. He has a model where he basically says the challenge of sustaining democracy and rule of law ultimately depends on a giant coordination problem among the people.
Mm-hmm.
So just to illustrate, if Mike Pence had failed to certify the election, and Trump had happened to stay on, you would have had 50 million Americans in the streets. The mm-hmm. country would have come to a stop. And we all know yeah. this. We would have been out. We've not let that happen.
Yeah.
Mike Pence would have lost his reputation. Yeah. It would be violence. And that would all be Trump's fault. And so somehow in the shadow of that, everyone is making their calculations. Now, suppose you have a country without any revolutionary tradition
yeah.
in which democracy came. Let's say Uzbekistan.
Yeah.
You guys just kind of got lucky that the Soviet Union
collapsed.
Fell apart.
Exactly, yeah.
And it wasn't taken from below by the
Correct.
People.
Correct.
It's pretty hard to imagine that that mechanism is going to operate in a country
exactly,
like that.
Yeah.
So I can't tell you, take this magic pill and all of a sudden you get that mechanism. You do have, though, societies where that mechanism does exist, in which are dictatorships, and those are interesting places to watch. I think Iran is a very interesting place to watch because it's obviously a terrible dictatorship. They kill their people. They foment violence around their neighborhood.
But they have elections.
They have elections, and the elections are constrained, you know, in terms of who can run. But the people have a revolutionary tradition several times, of course, in Iranian history since 1906. You know, the people get together and they're like, we're not putting up with this. So that's a constraint on the level of abuse that Iran can do. And so, but when I think about societies like yours or societies which don't have that, I think the best route is the South Korea route or the Taiwan route.
Rule by law.
So. Well, yeah, you have rule by law for a while, but then, largely in those cases because of geopolitics, you have an alliance with a liberal order, in some sense, a liberal power, and that creates seeds in the society where people are like, no, we don't want to live like this anymore, once they reach a certain level of wealth. Democracy, obviously, is not a universal system of government that is possible in every society at every place. Yeah. I strongly believe that. That's why, as a matter of international law, my last book, I talk about how there's no right to democratic governance. We shouldn't make a right out of something which is quite contingent. But from what we know of those conditions, a certain level of wealth and education are pretty important. And, you know, that I think once you reach a certain level of wealth and education, you know, with a certain level of openness, there will be pressures for democracy and the rule of law. It's hard to know. It's a dynamic world. We have this techno-authoritarianism of China now, which it's exporting rather actively. And that obviously, you know, China is not going to democratize. There's no question about that, even if they do get to a certain level of wealth and education. But, you know, for a very long time, societies which did reach that level of wealth and education, a certain level of wealth and education, you'd see great pressure to liberalize.
How contagious do you think is rule of law in terms of like geographic vicinity?
Yeah, I think it's much less contagious than democracy. Nice. So democracy, we know that there's contagion effects. You know, the Arab Spring was a series of attempts. Rule of law obviously is less so because it depends so much on very complicated, highly contingent and dispersed institutional investments and, you know, dynamics. So it is very, very hard. And as you said before, it's a lot easier to observe in its absence than in its presence.
I see. Because, you know, I keep on thinking about places like Afghanistan. Why? Because it's the place where things went south, like really bad. And you would think that ex-ante people who are trying to design it, they were doing it in earnest. Like they wanted pluralistic Afghanistan and so on. And I was thinking about what are the sort of legal or design mistakes they made to the system. And one of the literatures I stumbled upon was that, I think you mentioned this, is uniformity of power. Again, sorry for using that term. I'm not sure it's appropriate, but like sort of Jeffersonization of of Karzai was probably problematic, people say. And you know, the critics of them, they say, you know, in places like Afghanistan where there's a lot of violence, if violence is not centralized, it's bad. So there's a trade-off. And in trade-off, they chose more centralization because of the violence. Like, and, you know, that kind of explanations don't leave me hopeful. So what gives you hope in that situation?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think one very well-known observer of Afghanistan, Barney Rubin, who's been going there for quite a long time, his diagnosis was that when they decided in Bonn not to include the Taliban, that was the beginning of the end. Because
a lot of people say that,
That they should have just included them. And of course, the Americans couldn't because they had just supported bombing us. So for political reasons, the Bush administration, among its many, many mistakes, failed to be inclusive. And that goes back to my argument that you have to be inclusive of all the major power holders. So that would have certainly helped. There's no way Afghanistan was ever going to become Switzerland. And there's something quite unique I've learned about Pashtun society. It's very centrifugal. It's very...
decentralized?
It's very decentralized. And there's lots of rivalry even within the family, even within clans and such. essentially to stereotype things, you know, there's rivalry, and you only come together when some outsider threatens you. And that's true at the level of the family and the village and the province and ultimately of the country. And so there may be literally nothing that could have been done in Afghanistan, but some things that could have been done to improve things, being more inclusive at the beginning, not just pumping money to an extremely corrupt Karzai. Have many stories about his personal corruption and those of his elite. And the question is how much institution building should have been tried. And I don't know, I think in the end of the day, it's hard for me to know like what a comprehensive assessment would look like. I can't get away from the fact that we did educate the international community collectively, got 10 million girls educated. That's a pretty significant achievement, notwithstanding all the various problems. The glass might be a quarter full.
This was about Iraq, but I think it was relevant to Afghanistan. I think some U.S. military person, again, I'm blanking on his name, was writing about their experience of training local armed forces. And they say that they noticed that Iraqis that they were working with had more loyalty to their sort of kin and tribe than to nation state.
Absolutely.
And the conclusion that political scientists or like a legal scholar would make out of it, I think, out of this observation, if true, again, mm-hmm. you can argue if it's true or not, is that in that kind of place, it's really hard to build this myth of the government or loyalty to the nation, where the notion of loyalty, because people identify themselves as certain tribe or people in Afghanistan say they're Pashtun or
right.
rather than Afghan.
Yeah.
So in that kind of place, it's really difficult to build a nation state in a modern understanding of it. So how much do you think this is relevant to the point of writing a constitution?
Well, it's true. I mean, so we have some countries by which the constitution constitutes the people. Mm-hmm. Like without the constitution, there is no America.
Correct. Yeah.
Afghanistan obviously isn't like that. It's always been plural, but there is this Afghan identity that binds everybody, and it's very tied with Islam. Mm-hmm. And so you don't really need a constitution to create that identity. And the fact is it was a piece of paper on top of a structure that had its own logic. Mm-hmm. I think about a country like Uzbekistan. Okay, so Uzbekistan obviously is a strong statist tradition mm-hmm. of the Russian mold. And so you do have some ingredients of a kind of a nation state idea that you could build on, even though it's very plural. The geopolitics kind of help sometimes. I think about Taiwan and Korea. Those were countries that had no choice but to modernize there because they were confronted.
Surrounded by,
in each case, an alternative vision of the nation embodied in a powerful country, a powerful enemy. And so they had to show that, they had to get it right. And that constrains opportunism and helps control agency costs, I think. And so Uzbekistan's an interesting place right now with the changing geopolitics of Central Asia, in the sense where there's a premium on maintaining independence in a region where you got countries invading their neighbors and your neighbors and such. And so, I don't know. You do have some raw ingredients, I think, for this kind of national consciousness. But it's a young country and might be hard to build.
Because one of the downsides is that nationalism is also not a net positive all the time, right?
It may
lead to really ugly outcomes.
There's a famous result in political science. New democracies tend to go to war quite a bit. Because they have weak institutional structures and sometimes they foment tensions with their neighbors.
I was thinking about when I was listening to your lectures and reading through your work, I was thinking about this idea of Douglas North, mm-hmm. where he basically says that in sort of high growth societies or like developed societies, the elites write the rules for themselves and they kind of follow it. And then in non-developing places, the elites write the rules for the public and exceptions to them to themselves, basically. And that what, I mean, this is kind of almost by definition, divides countries into rich and poor.
Yeah, it sounds very much like Acemoglu and Robinson in a way.
Correct, correct, yeah, yeah, yeah. And
I guess he beat them to it.
I think they cite his work.
I'm sure, yeah. He's a giant.
Yeah, yeah, and so I was thinking about this idea in a sense like, can we say the same thing about basically constitutions and like we can formalize what Douglas North was saying in an empirical way, in a sense like constitutions that were written by the elites for governing among themselves is what distinguished sort of high potential countries. But in a lot of places, like I'm sure people who are writing constitutions in failed states and so forth, they almost ex ante knew they're not going to follow this.
Yeah.
They're doing it for, you know, legitimization, to get money from the World Bank,
yeah,
or
right,
whatever.
Right.
Like,
right.
You know, whatever the reasons. Like, Stalin had his own reasons, as you said. But he had no, I think, how would you call it? Naiveness? Naivete?
Naivete.
He had no naivete, I think, that he's going to follow through whatever he's writing. So he knew that, or like the Soviet Politburo, basically, knew that the rules they're writing, it is for the people to follow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in America, it was like powerful generals of the independence, War of Independence, who are trying to figure out their, you know, their estate's protection of the property of their estate and value. So they were writing the rules for themselves. And that was the distinguishing factor. So how much you buy that?
Look, I mean, some people say a successful constitution is a dual bargain. It's a bargain among the elites, and it's a bargain between the elites and the society itself and the mass. And so that dual character is complicated. It's hard to negotiate such a thing. And you could have many failed attempts that look like they're a written constitution, but they don't really solve that fundamental problem. So I think that's a good way of thinking about it. We do have examples of authoritarian systems in which the constitution is an elite bargain. Very famous example I mentioned before is Chile, where the constitution was adapted by Augusto Pinochet. And he was planning to give up power to the civilian society, but within limits, there would be certain neoliberal reforms and interest group bargains for his people that were protected in that. But it also provided, we think, a kind of a structure for coordination among the military services. This is the argument of a scholar named Robert Barros, who died some time ago. But he showed how the Army, Navy, and Air Force actually needed this constitution to coordinate among themselves, rather interestingly. So that's a classic example where it's serving a dual function. And that sort of works. You might think of the constitution of India or something like that as also something where, boy, you have a lot of, you know, myriad differences among people. There's one major political party, but they're really thinking about a bargain with the society, how to be developmental, but also how to constrain an extremely plural society, an extremely plural elite. And, you know, so those are very effective ones. You know, but we obviously have many examples of ones which are not, which are just simply window dressing. One of the things that we discovered is that you can tell the health of a constitution, oddly, by how much amendment is going on. An amendment, if you think about it, is an investment in the text. It's saying, hey, this was costly to get this text. Now we want to change it. We want to invest more political energy into it. So we have these examples of constitutions like that of Mexico or India or Brazil, where they're amended almost every year. And you might say, well, that's not very constitutional. But in a way, it shows that there's an investment in that document, in that framework, as being the basis of elite bargains and bargains with the society. And again, it might not be perfectly optimal. There's lots of interest group stuff going on. But given that there's these side benefits, positive externalities in terms of stability, not a bad thing.
Okay. So we're talking about amendments. And one of the amendments that people who listen to this podcast, which, by the way, majority are from former Soviet countries, obviously, is change in Russian constitution to let Putin rule in indefinitely. He did it through the amendment.
Yes, he did.
So what do you think of it as a legal procedure, and what do you think of it given your theory? Why didn't he, like, he used to, if you're, I mean, for...
Yes, right.
Yeah, he used to
leave power for a minute. He had a trustworthy successor, you know. So, yeah, I'm actually writing a book on this. I have a number of papers on term limit extensions. And, you know, the various strategies. His first move was actually legally compliant. We wouldn't say there was anything illegal
wrong
about
with it, yeah.
Yeah, becoming prime minister for a short while and then coming back one term. But now what he's doing is much more Mugabe.
Correct.
You know, much more like finding ways to just, you know, ram things through. And Xi Jinping also did this recently. Mm-hmm. In Xi Jinping's case, it was a very risky thing to do, very costly, and he really laid the groundwork because, of course, China had had a norm of two terms and a very strictly observed one since Deng Xiaoping because of their fear of having another Mao Zedong.
But let me kind of add to this, is that in China it was a norm, like a tradition. But yeah. In Russia, it was like a legal requirement that the president has to step down after two terms.
Yes.
So Xi Jinping changed the tradition, but well, Putin changed the law. Why do you think Xi Jinping's case was more riskier?
Well, first of all, Xi Jinping had to change the constitution because the terms that the president of China is also the president of the Central Military Commission and the secretary general of the Communist Party. So you got these three roles. You need all three of them to have power. And the president of the country required a term limit extension, even though, of course, it's not the real source of power. Mm-hmm. You're editing this podcast, right?
Correct.
So I have to double check that because I can't remember the exact provision he changed, but let's check that. But anyway, so he did have to change it. And the difference is that in China, you really have a complicated institutional structure. The Chinese Communist Party has 70, 80 million people, 90 million people, and it's got lots of rules, and one man really doesn't control everything. Putin has been in power for so long, he's got so many tools, informal tools of control, that there wasn't much risk that he would be challenged. So that's why I was saying it was more risky for Xi Jinping than for Putin to stay on. You know, the question is, why didn't he, change it many years ago? He could have done that. Why now? And I'm not sure I understand that. Why leaders would want to pretend that they're going to be constrained by these term limits, because it's always costly and a little risky to change it. And the reason it's risky to change it has to do with that wine gas model I was saying before, where the mechanism of preserving democracy is the masses rising up. Doesn't happen very often, but it's more likely to happen when you have a very clear constitutional rule that everyone knows and can see the violation. Constitution says a 5-year term for president. Now you're here on the 6th year. No one is fooled by that. And that could lead to mass uprising. So, you know, these are very clear provisions, and their violation is pretty routine and most of the time successful, but sometimes not in some dictatorships.
I see. So so help me understand. Because Russia had a clear stipulation on term limits, you said it would be riskier. But on the other hand, Putin was in power for so long that reduces his risk. Is that a model?
In general, term limit violations require some level of risk. I don't think among dictators it was very high for Putin.
I see.
I think he had lots of control. I think Xi Jinping's risk was higher. He had to take many more steps before he could make that move because he was really changing not just the law but the norm. Whereas Putin, I think part of it, and I don't understand the man well, but he was trained as a lawyer. And Russia has a long tradition of rule by law, of law being important to the state, of the backbone of the state. And so I think he was playing in, you know, following the procedures, you know, having a fixed term. Those are things which kind of fit into that ideology.
Yeah, I think they have this legalistic mind. Sometimes.
Exactly, But again, it's not a rule of law mind. It's a rule by law mind.
But again, you know, there's, I would say, a long tradition of like spirit of the law versus like the letter of the law. Like, is that how?
Yeah,
talk about it? So, like, I think everybody in Russia knew that whatever Putin is doing, even his supporters, I think, clearly knew that whatever he was doing is not clear cut like before he did. Like before when he did this rotation, it was obvious that, you know, if Alien would be a judge in that court, he would say, yeah, whatever he did was kind of fine. But an Alien, if Alien in a sense like a judge who is like absolutely independent would rule what Putin did right now, it would be hard for them to buy that this was like a clear, how can I say, a clearly lawful transition of power.
Well, I'm not so sure. After all, it would depend on the text of the Constitution. Constitution might say, you know, there's the president has a 5-year term that can be renewed once. And then the legalistic president, who is a dictator, mm-hmm. comes along and says, you know, we're going to amend that provision. We're going to follow all the proper procedures in doing that amendment. I think the rule of law is under the rule of law, that's not necessarily a wrong thing to do. Mm-hmm. As long as you follow the procedures. That's at least one vision of the rule of law, that you just make sure the procedures are followed and that's okay. Now, it would be different if he just, the term comes, is over and he just stays on in power or does something that Donald Trump tried to do. That would be quite different.
Now, I guess what I meant is when they amended the Constitution, they said the previous version of it goes to zero and then Putin has started his first term.
Yeah, right.
So that is, so they basically said we zero out the whole tradition, like whatever happened before that date to zero.
Yeah.
And then we started from day one. So I think that was the pretense that people had.
I get it. And this is an issue that arises a lot in new constitutional reforms and in general around term limits. Because on the one hand, the president is escaping the term limit by just passing a new constitution. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it's not obvious that a term served under the previous constitution should automatically not count. I mean, this is being faced in a small country called the Gambia now. So the Gambia was run by a dictator who had a military coup for a long time, no term limits. He gets defeated. New president comes in, is serving his term, and now they want to pass a constitution that says, we're going to pass term limits and you only get one. We're going to count your term. And that new president, democratically elected, says, you know, I don't think so. I'd like to stay on. And they're fighting over this. And it's not.
And so how does a court think about it, or should think about it? Like, I'm asking you as a lawyer, like, how the court should think
I don't
about
think
it?
That there's a genuine universal right answer there. As a matter of formalism, you can certainly tell yourself the story that the new constitution, particularly if it's clear on this point, is resetting the clock to zero. I don't see why that's not an acceptable answer.
I see.
As a formal legal matter. In terms of the spirit of democracy, obviously it's not.
Yeah.
And the rule of law is not really about the spirit of democracy. The rule of law is about the rule of law. It's a separate conceptual structure about following the rules and making sure that people obey them. Interestingly, in Africa, they confront this a lot. And so they have adopted a regional norm for the continent that prohibits unconstitutional changes in governance, unconstitutional changes in power.
What does that mean?
That means coup d'etat. Mm-hmm. And they clarified that also means term limit extensions that would extend the term of the existing office holder. Oh. So under that system, that regional system, the answer to your question would clearly be that the prior terms would count in any calculation. Mm-hmm. But you need some sort of norm, some legal norm on which to hang your hat as a lawyer.
Yeah, I guess in Russia, what they did to make it legalistically clear is that they added some other provisions to the Constitution. Something about the family being enshrined in the law or whatever, so that
it didn't like look an independent reform.
It didn't look like, you know, we're changing the constitution just so that Putin can have one more term.
Yeah,
it was more like, oh, we're just doing this constitutional reform. Oh, but yeah, sure, we have some additions about, you know, term limits, but it was like under this sauce of general constitutional reform. So I see. So then, from a legalistic point of view, they may have had. Like from rule of law point of view, they may have some arguments in a real court as well, what you're saying.
Yeah, I think so.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
And I guess the sort of final question and thoughts that I want to hear from you would be that you've recently been to Uzbekistan.
I have.
You have met members of society, government, lawmakers, judges, students, and so on. And so what do you think of Uzbekistan in terms of, you know, its current form and its future, like given your experience around the world?
Yeah, look, I've been to a lot of countries and I liked Uzbekistan a lot. First of all, I think the way things are developing is very incremental. This is not a, radically, suddenly democratizing society or anything like that. It's very incremental, but you had the sense that it was moving in the right direction, I would say. The reforms seem to be genuinely something people are talking about. There's genuine, it seems like institution building going on, which is what's necessary for the midterm growth to be sustainable. Somewhat of a culture of entrepreneurship. You don't have too many resources. You don't have the resource curse relative to the size of your population.
Okay.
And so I was fairly bullish on Uzbekistan. I think it seemed
like
a society was going.
You would buy it stock if it was
available. I checked. There's no way to buy it on the New York Stock Exchange. It might be a good business opportunity. Do a UD, SDR or something like that for the. But obviously there's some risk in terms of the geopolitics of the neighborhood. And you would know better than me, but it strikes me that this whole invasion of the Ukraine was just a bad move for Russia. I just don't understand it. It seems like a world historical mistake in which you're squandering
the reputation.
Not just the reputation, the lives of the young people, the legitimacy of the country. And in a way, there is one advantage from Uzbekistan, because one thing I can tell you that I saw in the streets there, I saw a lot of Russians, And those, on the one hand, I know there's probably some tensions around that. I don't know about Uzbekistan, countries. Some of the other countries where you have all these young Russians, there's some tensions. But that's a lot of human capital that's just been dropped into your country. And, if there's ways to sort of exploit that for the benefit of the Uzbek people, I think that's another kind of weird gift of geopolitics in this time. But, obviously there's lots of challenges for any country developing at that stage of growth.
Just FYI, Tom doesn't read my blog because it's in Uzbek.
Yeah.
Because I've written about exactly the same thing.
Oh, really?
So I said, the Russian human capital is like gold pouring from the sky. We should just put the bucket and just cash it out.
Nice, nice, yeah.
And it was like an idea that I have been like pushing a lot, and obviously I get pushback on it. So it was not premeditated at all.
No,
we haven't spoken about it.
No idea. How many Russians are there in Uzbekistan? What's the estimate?
Like 20,000.
Yeah, so
it's not a lot.
This is great. I mean, you look at for example, Israel. Country in the news, but one of the things that really pushed Israel's massive growth in the last decade or two, a couple of decades, was a big influx of Russians.
Soviet.
Yeah, they got like a million people in the
1990s. And a few hundred thousand from Uzbekistan, you know that, right?
Oh, yeah, I heard that, yeah.
Yeah. So big immigration to Israel happened from Uzbekistan.
Yeah, and that's a brain drain from Uzbekistan, but the point is now you're getting, as you say, a little bit of human capital gift from the sky. And the question is always, how do you integrate them? And you got to make sure, obviously, that they're tax-paying citizens and all that, or tax-paying beneficiaries.
Residents, yeah.
Your residents. So, that requires state institutions. And this is, again, where the tradition of a strong executive branch that you have in that part of the world can be helpful if it's channeled in good ways. It really can. I often think from a legal point of view, one of the most important areas of law is administrative law. Mm-hmm. Administrative law, which is the law making sure that low-level agents are not
corrupt.
Yeah. And it's there's not a great tradition necessarily. Soviets had their own theory of administrative law. It was very different from ours. But if you think about it as agency control, it's a pretty important area of law and one that is a little below the radar. Everyone likes to talk about constitutions because they're big and fancy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we can all kind of get our heads around them. But the technical details of making sure that administrative structures are acting for the benefit of the nation and not stealing from people and not disincentivizing investment. As you know from the development literature, there's lots of examples of countries where people with great ideas don't want to invest in things which are visible to the state agents because the state agents will take them. And I didn't get the sense. I mean, I saw a lot of commerce in Uzbekistan. It seemed like people were willing to invest in businesses and shops and buildings and things like this. They weren't afraid that by building a building, they'd have it taken by the government. That fear is a big thing in Africa.
I agree.
You can go to many countries in Africa and you see the newest building was built by the French colonialists.
Correct. Yeah.
Because the entrepreneur knows if I build this building, some state...
It's going to be expropriated, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that this is something very fragile that Uzbekistan has to cherish in a sense of like people's trust. Mm-hmm. It could be objectively not that dangerous, but people can still be afraid in investing. And once they start being afraid, this is like a spiral.
Absolutely,
of downhill.
Yeah.
It's really hard to like reverse the reverse course. One thing I have had an experience with in Uzbekistan was that, you know, we have a relatively strong executive branch and relatively weak judiciary and lawmaking, legislative branch.
That's right.
And in a discussion, and as it pertains to the economy, like budget and taxes, so I was in the discussion, and there was discussion between sort of people in the executive branch and legislative branch. And executive branch, it was about tax code. And executive branch was saying, you know, we want this and that and this in the tax code. And I was like, you know, we usually really let the legislative branch to come up with this idea and, you know, actually follow the constitution as it's written.
Yeah.
And this executive branch person who was very candid, he said, like, you know that they can't write that law.
Yeah.
Because they had like capacity. Like all economists and tax people work for us.
Yeah.
So what they do, the legislators, they just rubber stamp our decision. He didn't say that word exactly, but he said like they would accept our decision because we have expertise and they lack expertise because they are, you know, farmers, teachers, and whatever, whoever are. So how do you think about it in that sense, if the capacity are concentrated in one place?
Look, this is a general trend of modern governance. Like, you look at our U.S. Congress.
Yeah.
It's a clown show. I wouldn't expect them to be able to draft any serious legislation whatsoever. Globally, for major issues we're confronting as a society, privacy on the internet,
like, or artificial intelligence,
all
or whatever,
of this, you know who we look to? We look to the European Union. And the European Union is not... Law is not made by legislators, it's made by bureaucrats from the countries that get together and draft the rules. And so we're in a modern government is made by executive branches and courts. Courts are very important. And I think having both of them is important because you do need some check. You need procedural checks to make sure that legislation and sub-legislation is drafted and produced in appropriate ways. But legislatures all over the world are finding their reputations to be very low. And I don't think we should necessarily worry too much about that. I don't think we should go back and repair the, obviously we should repair the reputations of legislators, but I don't think we should go back to a world where we expect them to draft the rules themselves because there's no way they'd have the capacity. What you want, what they provide us with is legitimacy and an arena for contesting the big ideas in society in a democracy. They're an arena, not really a law-producing body.
Yeah, the problem with bureaucrats drafting laws, in my opinion, is that they would draft it in a way that makes their life easy.
True.
Right? Like if you are a tax code person who has to collect taxes from the society, you would want to draft a law that makes your work the easiest.
Well,
and the costs, you don't care about the cost that society may bear because for like from your kind of perspective...
Yeah.
Or like if we let the police to draft laws around arrests, for example,
right.
They would draft it in a really different way. And so it's saying that we don't let the police to draft the laws around most of the crimes. I mean, right?
So this it's the agency problem again. But, you know, we do have some movements in thinking about government, trying to make government simpler. This book by my former colleague, Cass Sunstein, Nudge, which is like you set up the rules in a way that make things super simple for the members of the public. If you have those design principles in mind... Then, and that is something which the legislature could insist on demanding. If they have political power, they could make sure that those laws are subject to, you know, some general constraint, like being simple to use and things like this. So I think there might be a role for that. International agencies, the World Bank, and these things are now into these ideas too. You know, the U.S. is just terribly run in this way. We have a very complicated tax code. We have very... you know, poorly drafted legislation, very hard to change things. This is true at the national level and even at the level of the city. Somehow, though, we keep growing. We have this amazing growth machine that we've had for, you know, it's 3% growth for over 200 and something years.
Yeah.
So that's compounding.
I mean, even in the last 6 years, I think it's the largest gain since like 2018 among the developed nations. Like no country even came remotely. Poland was pretty close, but like given... I mean, U.S. is a lot richer than Poland. So, like,
bigger too. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah,
it's incredible how it grows so fast.
It's a growth machine, and that has to do with certain institutions, even though so many of the institutions that we can observe aren't very good.
Correct, correct.
But we do have a lack of predation. You can't have your stuff stolen. We have a very entrepreneurial culture. We have very thick markets for capital and things like this. And we have
good bureaucracy, I think.
We have okay bureaucracy. Some of them are better than others. And we have good educational infrastructure, good investment in human capital. So, there's a lot of things going right in the U.S., but it could be much better, let me tell you. If we had these regulatory principles of making things easier for the citizen, we'd do much better. So that's something I'd like to see even at the level of the city and the state here in the United States.
Hopefully. So the last question is, let's imagine you are a student of law or economics or political science, and you want to know about constitutional order or why constitutions matter. Obviously, we would recommend to read your book. But other than that, what's the literature there? Like, what are the authors or chapters or books that one can read for their entertainment if they're interested in that?
Yeah.
Or knowledge, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, when I think of like who are the classic writers in our field, there's a paper from 1995 by Jan Elster, who's a professor at Columbia, he's retired in Paris. That paper from 1995, I still think about.
Really?
And it's really one of those powerful papers, like Wine Gas, 1997. Yeah, yeah. You know, we have these classic papers which really repay. In fact, I just did a book which I called Constitution Makers on Constitution Making. So I interviewed many people who had been drafting constitutions, and I gave them this framework from the 1995 article, and I tried to update the framework in light of this real-world experience. Mm-hmm. But that paper, Jan Elster, I think is a fantastic one. So that's something I recommend quite a bit. I'm trying to think what else I would recommend. Most of the problems with the American scholars is that they're just obsessed with America.
Correct.
And they're not really thinking about the problems of the rest of the world. I'm much more interested in the problems of the rest of the world than I am in America. I mean, I'm a citizen, so I love the country and I want it to succeed. But for the most part, I'm quite interested in the fundamental question of where constitutional democracy comes from, how it's sustained, and how ultimately it can degrade and how it ends.
Yeah,
so that's the large question motivating my research. And I think it's, one that I encourage people in your country, scholars in your country, to really think about, because I think it's one that really could be very helpful for the development of Uzbekistan, if you can really think about getting to that point of constitutional democracy.
You've mentioned Cas Sunstein, right? You said he was your colleague?
Yeah.
He has a book on constitutional orders, right? I'm blanking on the title, but I've read it. How do you call it?
He has a lot of books. He writes so many books.
Yeah, yeah. But he has a book on constitutions.
Yeah, he has many. Yeah, yeah.
So,
he used to sit right next door through that wall.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. He's in Harvard now or something.
Yeah, he moved to Harvard.
Oh, okay.
Right after I got here, he decided I drove him away.
No, what I mean is like, let me re-ask this question. So, are there like a popular writers, if you will, to people who are not like sort of professional scholars?
You know, it's funny. Yeah, you'd think there'd be a better popular literature on this. And I can't think of a great popular book. I mean, like, Cass is very good. I'm racking my brains as you've asked the question for a good pop book. There's a book on the history of constitutions by a British scholar. What the hell is her name? Which is called The Gun, the Pen, and the Sword. A book called The Gun, the Pen, and the Sword.
Oh, I think I've seen this.
Yeah, and it's kind of a global history of constitutions. I like the book. I think she's ultimately wrong. She emphasizes the importance of war in making constitutions. Okay, that's fine. But that's quite a good readable book. Very nice, popular kind of thing. Oh, and there's a popular book by a guy named Wim Voormans. He's a Dutch scholar. And it's called The Story of Constitutions. And it was a bestseller in the Netherlands. He wrote it in Dutch and it became a runaway bestseller. And he's trying to explain constitutions as governance technology for the average person. So that might be an interesting book to look at. Fairly easy to read.
Thank you. This was Tom Ginsberg of University of Chicago. Thank you, Tom. And thank you for your time and wonderful answers.
Thank you, Beck. It's been wonderful talking to you, getting to know you, and looking forward to my next visit to Uzbekistan.
Yeah, we'll see you there.
I hope so.